This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
The word strong is a curious word, right? I mean, yeah, there's the obvious use of the word strong to refer to physical strength, but strong can refer to coffee, which I think is a good thing. I'm very much in favor of strong coffee. I'm very much not in favor of weak coffee. That's not a good outcome. Strong can refer to smell. Like if you're around something that smells, it can be a strong smell to you. Strong can refer to chairs. This chair is strong. It's able to hold me up. I'm getting ready to travel to a sunny place. Sorry. And I've learned that sunscreen can have different strengths, right? So you got SPF 15, 30, or like 150, whatever you can get. It's a broad range of uses when we use that word strong. And today, in this chapter, we're going to think about God's strength, God's power, God's ability, what sets him apart. And really, 1 Samuel has been showing us a lot about God's strength as we've studied it. As the book began, you might remember the use of strong that came up in chapter 1 where Hannah is in the temple praying, and Eli immediately thinks she's been having some strong drink. She's been hitting the liquor bottle too much. That's why she's talking and her lips aren't moving, and this is all weird. But it was out of a deep burden that she had that Hannah was praying. And in chapter 2, we've talked a lot about Hannah's prayer. And it's so huge to see that because 2 Samuel is going to end with a prayer, and 1 Samuel begins with a prayer. And in chapter 2, in verse 4, Hannah would pray and ask God to show how the bows of the mighty would be broken and the feeble or the weak would put on strength. Later in her prayer in verse 10, Hannah would say, "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them God will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." This is what God's going to be doing in the book of 1 Samuel. Later in chapter 2, Eli was assured that his legacy and strength would be cut off. And even in recent chapters, Saul would find those who were strong, and he would unite to them to create military alliances. And last time, Saul was connected to the Lord's anointed, David. Saul was tied to a man of valor, and the Lord was with David. So in today's passage, God's strength will be seen. Now, you might know 1 Samuel 17 is David and Goliath. So this is what we're talking about today, this story. And the reason I'm putting it in terms of God's strength is because we so often just hear this story used to illustrate anything in life that's difficult. Like Kansans facing the water, it's like a David and Goliath thing or something. You know, these two teams meeting in the finals of this NBA game or like a David and Goliath clash. And really, it's about God's strength, the whole passage is. So we're going to try to look at that today. What helps me make sense of Bible passages as I'm reading them are to look for words that are used consistently. And in this chapter, 1 Samuel 17, there's a word that's used consistently that means reproach or defy or mock or deride. This is used in verses 10, 25, 26, two times, and in verses 36 and 45. So this is the issue, right? Because God's enemies have heaped this reproach or have defied God, the issue of this chapter is how God's going to display his strength in the midst of weakness of those who trust him and stand up for him against these enemies. God's strong. We already know that, right? None of us probably walked in here today and I said, okay, if you could think of the strongest deity in the world, who would that be? We don't have any question. We know that God is the strong one. And we've already seen that in the book of 1 Samuel, right? Remember how God marched into the Philistine area all by himself and in the ark? Remember when the ark was captured? So the Philistines put their ark before Dagon, their god. And what happened to Dagon? Well, he fell down face first before the ark. So they brought in all the God lifters, raised him back up. The next day, this time he's fallen on his face and his head and his arms were cut off. God totally annihilated the Philistines. Remember the tumors and all this? So God annihilated them and they sent him back to Israel. They sent the Ark of the Covenant back to Israel. So God's strong. He's got that. He's already defeated the Philistines once all by himself. And today God's going to defeat his enemies again in a way that showcases his strength through the weakness of others. In 1 Samuel 17, we're also meeting what one writer says is the public presentation of a spirit-filled warrior. We're seeing him. Whereas in chapter 16, we saw God anoint David privately. Now in chapter 17, everyone in Israel is going to know that there's somebody who you don't play games with, and that's David. Someone who is tied to God's heart. Everyone's going to see this. There's going to be this public presentation of a spirit-filled warrior. So today, God's enemies scoff at him, and we're going to see David introduced before the people as one who can show or demonstrate God's strength. So as we think about what this might mean for our lives, what impact does God's strength have in your life? I mean, what does the fact that he's strong mean to you? Now, maybe on one level, you've never considered God's strength and what that would look like displayed in your life. One writer has famously said that we become like what we worship. We become like what we're worshiping. We're going to see that play out in today's passage. So if we worship ourselves, and if we're all wrapped up in what's best for me, then that worship is going to lead us to become something. It's going to lead us down a path. So are you building your life on God or on your own self? And so my ultimate goal today is I'm hoping to draw your heart up and out in worship to God. If you've bowed your knee to him and you worship him, if you relate to him out of a relationship through his son, then does his strength matter in your life? And what does his strength mean for all the stuff that we're anxious about? All the anxiety we have? Our concern about the nature of the world, and it might be just even this week, just with waters rising. How does God's strength inform that? Or maybe it's the nature of the world in the sense of politically or other things you hear of happening. How does God's strength matter in those situations? Maybe even standing up for righteousness. How does God's strength impact that? Are you really leaning into him? Are you really trusting his strength? Or is there really just God's like, that's the right thing to say. Well, God's strong when I'm weak. But it's really all about you and how you're going to fix the stuff of this world. It's something to think about as we get into this. So let's see how God works through this familiar story. And I invite you to join me as we see three ways that God displays his strength. Three ways that God displays his strength. So let's start reading. We're going to try to read this whole chapter. And let's begin reading in verse 1. Here's what we read there. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up the line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armored with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had eight sons. In the days of Saul, I lost my place here. It's crazy. I have this little bit torn out of my Bible and I can't make out the word there. So, where am I at here? In the days of Saul, the man was already old. That's what I was looking for. The man was already old and advanced in years. And the three oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of the three sons who went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to his son, David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousand. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. So this is God's word. Thanks be to God. Three ways that God displays his strength. And so really, what I just read for you is kind of the setting of the scene. God displays his strength when facing an enemy. So we got to kind of get up to speed on what is going to take place, where God's going to display his strength. God displays his strength when facing an enemy. And in these opening verses, the scene is really set for the main action that's going to happen. There's something happening in Israel. That's the first few verses, right? We learned the location where this was taking place. It's between Socoh and Azekah. This is probably 12 to 14 miles west of the little town of Bethlehem. And battle lines were drawn there. On one side, Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and drawn up in battle line against the Philistines. And on the other side were the Philistines. So you get the picture, right? There's a valley laying between them. So in verse 4, we continue as we meet Goliath. And we're told a lot about this Goliath. We're told in verse 4 that he was a champion. Literally, in the original language, this means the man who was in between. And what it is kind of, if you think of these two armies on the sides of the valley in the middle, he was the one who would step in between. He would come in between those two armies and make his announcements. We're told he was tall, over 8 foot tall. He had a helmet of bronze, and his armor is described as a coat of mail. A coat of mail. That doesn't mean anything to me. So I looked at some other translations. The New American Standard brought out the effective. It's scale armor. It's like scales. And I think that's shown in your notes there. So this armor, Goliath is kind of presented to us like a snake, right? He's just kind of this like slinky kind of this scaly armor is all over him. His armor weighed over 125 pounds, armor on his legs and a javelin between his shoulders with a spear that was heavy as well. He had a shield bearer that went before him. And scarier than his armor was what he actually said, right? Why not come fight me? Our English translation doesn't bring this out. He says, am I not the Philistine? Am I not the man? And are you not slaves of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he defeats me, we'll be your slaves, but if I prevail, you'll be ours and serve us. And it gets more pointed in verse 10. You probably felt that as I was trying to stumble through the reading. In verse 10, he says, I defy, there's our word, I defy or I insult or I scorn or I mock the ranks of Israel this day. Send out someone to fight me. So when Saul and everyone hears this, none of them are saying, you know, this isn't a big deal for God. We're the people of God. He fights for us. No, everybody's terrified. Dismayed, greatly afraid. Not even Jonathan, who in chapter 14 went into battle courageously all by himself. Not even Jonathan had the courage to stand in this moment. So our passage, like, we need someone to intervene. Who will rescue these people? And how does the passage build? What happens next in verse 12? It says, but David, or now David. We're told that David was from Bethlehem in Judah. We already know this because we've read chapter 16, but this seems to be just a different presentation of him than what we saw in chapter 16. He was from Bethlehem in Judah. We're told he's an Ephrathite. Again, that's a big thing. The opening verse of 1 Samuel told the story of an Ephrathite, a no-name Ephrathite named Elkanah, who had a wife named Hannah. So Jesse had 8 sons. He was old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest went to fight with Saul, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. David was the youngest. He went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep. And for 40 days, Goliath would stand up in morning and evening and insult these people, taunt them. So Jesse urged his son David to take his brother some food of grain and bread and to take a gift to the commander. He was to see if everything was well and kind of get some sort of token to prove that things are well. And so the stage is set. The stage is set. God's going to show his strength in a real life situation, facing a real enemy. So what do we have in this passage? We have fraidy cat people. We have people that are terrified. They don't know what to do. We have prideful, mighty warriors. We have Saul, who hasn't done much in his entire reign. And he's just sitting there kind of plotting and scheming what he's going to do next. We have a father caring for his son, or his sons. We have some taunting. We have a lowly shepherd delivering Uber Eats to the front lines of the battlefield. Dispatch from Bethlehem. Hey, here's the cheese, the bread, and the grain. You know, will you deliver this? So Romans 8 tells us, we know that to be true, right? That if God is for us, who can be against us? Romans 8 asks that question. And yet, in a very real way, enemies do come against us, just like they did the nation of Israel in this passage, right? And God's going to come through for his people. He's going to show his strength. Using Hannah's language from chapter 2, verse 10. He will exalt the horn of his anointed. So God's going to show his strength in a real life situation here. That's how our passage begins. It continues. Our passage continues. Secondly, as God shows his strength in the heart of his faithful ones. God shows his strength in the heart of his faithful ones. I begin reading in verse 19. Follow along with me there. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded. And he came to the encampment as the host were going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the man in the middle, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of Israel, out of the ranks of the Philistines, and spoke the same words as before. And David heard them. David heard them. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. So we get a sense of what kind of heart David has here in verse 20, right? Saul and the men were still fighting, and David rose early in the morning. He left the sheep with the keeper and did exactly as his father said. A lot of commentators make a big deal about him getting up first thing in the morning and obeying his father. Like obedience was the first thing he did. No hesitation. His father wants him to do this. He's not waiting till like late in the day and saying, you know, I'm going to get around to what my dad's asked me to do sometime today. No, he's just going to immediately be obedient. And we know that's a huge thing in light of what we saw in chapter 15, this heart of obedience. So he came to the camp as the armies were going to their battle line shouting their war cry. And they drew up for battle. David left his things with the keeper of the baggage and went to visit his brothers on the front line. And they were talking, and as they were talking, the man in the middle, the Philistine champion, Goliath, came out. And then we're told, the emphasis is drawn there. What's different now? David heard him. David heard him. This is what's different. The men of Israel saw this and cowered in fear, and they remind one another of this one who's defied. There's our word again in verse 25. This one who's defied Israel. But the king has laid out some incentives, though. Anyone who kills this Philistine champion, there will be great riches, get the king's daughter, and evidently a tax break for his father's house, right? His house, his father will live free in Israel, right? This is a huge thing. I mean, who doesn't like a tax break? You know, I'm not the CEO of Amazon, but I could use one. Because he doesn't pay anything. So, whatever. So there's a tax break. This is a great thing. So David, like wanting to make sure that he's heard this right, asks again in verse 26, right? What will be done for the one who takes away this reproach? There's our word again, reproach, defy, insult. And then he asks, for who is this uncircumcised Philistine to defy, there's our word again, to defy the armies of the living God? David's like, this thing must not be. It can't be this way. I'm not going to allow God's reputation to be taken down in this way. So he had a heart different than all the other soldiers. All the other soldiers. The people assured David there would be a great reward. And so David works through this passage, and David's going to overthrow three tall guys. Okay? He's got to overcome three tall men in this, in the coming pages, in the coming verses. And the first tall man that he has to deal with is his older brother, Eliab. Look at verse 28. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. So Eliab, we know, 1 Samuel 16, he's tall and he's impressive. Remember when Samuel first laid eyes on Eliab, Samuel said, surely this is the one. And God said, no, we've already been down the road with the tall, handsome guy. It doesn't work. Okay? Saul's a train wreck. I need a king after my own heart, right? I need you to see as I see. And so Eliab, he's bothered by baby brother. What brings you here, he asks. How are the few sheep that you have there in the wilderness? I know you're presuming a lot. There's evil in your heart. You've come down just to see the battle. So compare Eliab's understanding of David's heart with God's estimation of his heart in chapter 16. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. God sees something in David and says, this is my man. Anoint him. This is the guy I've chosen. But Eliab doesn't see that. Then David just responds, am I not even allowed to ask a word? You know, am I not even allowed to ask about this? So in dealing with his older brother, he's dealing with someone who's looking at the outward appearance but not looking at the heart. He's dealing with someone who's relating to him, sees that something is going on but doesn't have the heart to act. That's what Eliab's doing. You know, kind of, we're in a pickle here. We don't need you mouthing, and we don't need your curiosity about the battle plans. What do you think you're going to do about it anyway? So David has to overcome that. He's not hearing Goliath the way David heard Goliath. David heard it, and something triggered, like, I'm not going to let God be defied in this way. David's not going to stand up for this maligning of God. So, tall number one, dealt with. Now David has to deal with tall man number two. This is Saul. In verse 31, when the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth, and he's been a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied," there's our word again, "the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the paw of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, "I can't go with these, for I've not tested them." So David put them off. And then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So the words are heard. Saul catches wind of this. So David appears before Saul. And at this point, David's ready to go fight. David says, "Let no man's heart fail because of this Philistine. I'll go fight him." And Saul's looking at the outward appearance, though, isn't he? Saul's not seeing as God sees. Saul looks at David and says, no. You can't go fight this Philistine. Saul's under the impression that God needs experience to win the battle. That God's strength needs someone who's a seasoned veteran, who's been through the fire. That's what God needs. God needs experience to win this battle. You're just a youth. This man's been fighting for years. He'll easily take you. It's almost as if both Eliab and Saul have been handed talking points for demoralizing the Israelite army, right? But David speaks up in verse 34. "Listen, I've been keeping sheep and fought off lions and bears. I've left the 99 to go after the one that was taken. I've risen against these animals, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be just like that." And why? What drove David to have this kind of confidence? It was the message from the Philistine. He has defied the armies of the living God. God delivered from paws of lions, paws and bears, and said delivering from the paws of Philistines is no big deal for him. He can do this. And by the way, just that reminder of when God defeated Dagon in 1 Samuel 5:4, when they rose early, Dagon had fallen downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left. So David has not only God on his side and a confidence in God on his side, he also has history, recent history. God's already defeated these Philistines once, and he knocked their arms off then. He delivered us from the paws of Dagon. In fact, he cut Dagon's arms off. So why are we worried about this person who's defying the armies of the living God? At this, Saul finally relents, even gives David a benediction, "Go, the Lord be with you." But Saul, who's the only person in the army with armor, remember that? He has sympathy, dresses David up in a helmet, coat of mail, sword. But David couldn't do this. He couldn't go out into battle with these because he hadn't tested them. But he did take his shepherd's staff, 5 smooth stones from the brook for a shepherd's pouch, a sling, and he approached the Philistine. So we finally get to tall man number 3. Tall man number 3. And by the way, the reason I say Saul was a tall man is, remember, when he was anointed king, he was a head taller than everyone else. This is a huge theme in this section of 1 Samuel. All these tall people. So tall man number 3, beginning in verse 41. "And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David and his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." And David, not to be out-trash-talked in this moment, in verse 45 says to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all in this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So, with this exchange with tall guy number three, we have this exchange of trash talk, right? We see pretty quickly, though, that that Goliath judges by outward appearance, right? Just like Eliab, just like Saul. Everyone in this passage is judging by outward appearance. Seems that not too many people see how God sees. So Goliath moves towards him. He looks and sees David, disdains him. He was but a youth. He was ruddy. So someone asked me this week, what does ruddy mean? It just means like he was bronzed. He was golden. He was kind of suntanned. He was like a gorgeous man, a lovely man. He was ruddy. And he was handsome in appearance, right? So that's what 1 Samuel 16:7 told us. The Philistine says, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And he cursed David and says, "Come on, I'll give you the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." But David speaks, and his confidence is like, it's not of this world, right? His confidence is somewhere else. "I'm not coming with swords, spears, or javelin. I'm just coming in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. You defied him. Now God's going to deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down, I'll cut off your head. And it's your dead body that's going to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth." So that's exactly what Goliath had said, right? The birds of the air, the beasts of the earth. Now David said, actually, God's going to do that, and you're the one that's going to those things. And this is going to happen so the earth knows there's a God in Israel. And this day will also show that God delivers and fights for his people and doesn't need swords or spears. The battle is his. And he's already won. Okay? It's over. That's what David's saying. This isn't really going to be a battle. This is about restoring God's honor. You've defied him, and I'm going to restore that honor today. In fact, God's going to restore his own honor, and I'm just going to be used to do that. So this warning is to God's enemies to stop their foolish defiance of Israel. Now we're going to get to the quick battle in a second. But God's displaying his strength in the heart of David. Do you see that? Do you see that? Everybody's against him. Even those in the nation of Israel are against him. The ones who should know that God fights for him are against him. Yeah, God's strong, but you need experience. Yeah, God's strong, but you need armor. Yeah, God's strong, but what are you doing? Just meddling here, you little brother? Yeah, God's strong, but... am I a dog that you come with me with sticks? See how there's just this perspective. I know none of us deal with that in this world we live in today. It's the same thing, right? God's displaying his strength in the heart of David. Whether it's facing the criticism from those who question his heart, or people that think that experience is needed for a battle like this, or even the enemy himself with threats and taunts, David stands firm in the strength of his God. God delights to display his power in the midst of weakness, in the midst of weak ones. God loves doing that. There's good news that David holds on to throughout the progression of this passage. God is strong, and he's with me. That's what David's holding on to through this. And so in the same way, we can have confidence that the one who has all authority in heaven and on earth will be with us, even to the end of the age. I mean, Jesus actually said that. That's the closing to Matthew 28. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Go make disciples, and surely I am with you, even to the end of the age. People may judge by outward appearances. They may question hearts. They may think you need something you don't. They may even taunt and defy you. But God is with us. God is with us. He will never leave us or forsake us. And we can confidently say that the Lord is our helper. We will not fear. What can man do to us? God loves you, and he's for you. So God shows his strength in the hearts of his faithful ones. Since it's raining and we're going to be here a while, let's get into point number three. Third and finally, how does this all end? Beginning in verse 50, God displays his strength in victory. God displays his strength in victory. He actually wins the day here, and he does this with no sword in David's hand. Look at verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaaraim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. So no sword in David's hand. But details of the battle are pretty simple. David prevailed with a slingshot and a stone. He struck the Philistine and killed him. No sword in his hand. Once he knocked him out, he ran over, grabbed his sword, and cut off his head. So Goliath became like the one he worshipped. Remember? He taunted David by his gods. And what happened to his god Dagon? Well, his head had been cut off before God. And now he became like what he worshipped. And the man in the middle, the Philistine champion, was dead. And the Philistines didn't become slaves to Israel as Goliath had promised, right? They fled. And the rout was on. The Israelites chased them back to their land and plundered them along the way. And then we have this curious verse 54. David took Goliath's head and brought it to Jerusalem. What's the problem with that? David doesn't enter Jerusalem until 2 Samuel 5:6. He's going to be on the run from Saul. So there is like a morbid detail. Like, is this like Braveheart when that head was sent to the guy? And like, what's going on here? Is like he going to carry around this head until he goes to Jerusalem? I don't know about that detail. I think what it's pointing to is the journey to becoming king and entering Jerusalem began here. It's going to end up in Jerusalem, with David ruling over all of Israel and Judah. So we're let in on a little secret here in verse 54, that this Philistine's head is going to be brought into Jerusalem. And by the way, in this passage, David was the one who crushed the head of the one who was presented as a snake. And this is what we can expect from the king of the people. And it also reminds us of what the true king would accomplish when he died and rose again. Our great enemy was defeated once and for all, and the snake no longer had power over us. The passage ends with some confusion about the son of Jesse, right? Let me read verse 55, and then we'll be through the chapter. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I don't know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." All this discussion about whose son this was, Saul wasn't asking who David was. He was wanting to be reminded who his father was. And so you might remember there was a promise in verse 25 that for the one who killed Goliath, his father's house would be free in Israel, receiving that tax break. And I think that's my best sense of what's going on here. Who is this? Whose son is this? They're going to get a tax break. So this entire story was about God displaying his strength in victory. And God continues to do that for us as well. Jesus entered Jerusalem to vindicate his father. That's what we're told about the triumphal entry. Blessed was the one who came in the name of the Lord. It was about honoring God's name and all that Jesus would do in his life, death, and resurrection. And so, the conclusion of that, 1 Corinthians 15:57 says, "Thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Our strength is in him, and the victory that he's won for us. Our strength is in God, and the victory he's won for us through Jesus Christ our Lord." So are you living out of that victory? Is that like defining your life? Like that you've triumphed? That you're more than a conqueror through him who loved you? Are you moping about in this world like some enemy is going to win the day? I mean, just think about what this means in terms of faith. So in conclusion today, we've seen three ways that God displays his strength. A lot of verses here and a lot of content, but I think it packs a punch. God displays his strength when he's facing an actual enemy. God shows his strength in the heart of his faithful ones. And God displays his strength in victory. So have you turned from fighting to trusting that the battle is the Lord's? Some of us are so wrapped up in the stuff of this world, and we're operating out of a Goliath way. That's how we're relating to this world. We see the world more like Goliath. Like we are way more concerned about the outward appearance, and we're not so concerned about the heart. We're fighting these battles in our own strength and not with the confidence in our strong God. So today then, one application is to simply realize that in Christ, you have everything that pertains to life and godliness and the knowledge of him. You are more than a conqueror through him who loved you and gave himself for you. So quit putting confidence in yourself, in your ingenuity, in your smarts, in your physical strength, in all the stuff that you bring to the table. Just stop it and put your confidence in the strongest one, in God. Trust in Jesus and do this every day. When you wake up in the morning, just, God, I'm a man in desperate need of help. I'm a woman, I need your help today. Be strong for me. Be my confidence. Just live that way every day. And there are times when the circumstances of life in this world overwhelm us, and we do tend to operate out of fear. We all do this, right? None of us in this room are David, right? None of you are going to go vanquish the enemy like David did. We are the Israelite army in this story. We're the ones that are scared for our lives. We're scared for our protection. We're scared for our families. We're scared for our own honor. And so today, would you just ask God to change your heart that you might relate to him and others out of a confidence in his strength? God loves displaying his power in weakness. 2 Corinthians 12, you know, that's the famous story where Paul had this thorn in the flesh that was sent to torment him. And finally, Saul reaches the conclusion where God says, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is displayed in your weakness. My strength is displayed in your weakness." So let's put our confidence in him. We have a strong God on our side. Let's put our confidence in him. And we'll be a people who glorify and enjoy him forever.